An Osho Talk. The Art of Dying. Talks on Hasidism. Number 7.
Rabbi Bunim used to tell young men who came to him for the first time the story of Rabbi Isaac, son of Rabbi Yekel, in Krakow. After many years of great poverty, which had never shaken his faith in God, he dreamed that someone bade him look for treasure under the bridge which leads to the king's palace in Prague. When the dream reoccurred the third time, he set out for Prague, but the bridge was guarded day and night, and he did not dare start digging. Nevertheless, he went to the bridge every morning and kept walking around it until evening. Finally, the captain of the guards, who had been watching him, asked in a kindly way whether he was looking for something or waiting for someone. Rabbi Isaac told him of the dream which had brought him from a faraway country. The captain laughed. "And so to please your dream you wore out your shoes to come here, you poor fellow. And as for having faith in dreams, if I had had it, I should have had to go to Krakow and dig for treasure under the stove in the room of a Jew, Isaac, son of Yekel. That's what the dream told me. And imagine what it would have been like. One half of the Jews over there are called Isaac, and the other half Yekel." And he laughed again. Rabbi Isaac bowed, travelled home, dug up the treasure from under his stove, and built the house of prayer which is called Reb Isaac's Shul. Rabbi Bunim used to add, "Take this story to heart and make what it says your own. There is something you cannot find anywhere in the world, not even at the Tzaddik's, and there is nevertheless a place where you can find it."
A life is a search, a constant search, a desperate search, a hopeless search. Search for something one knows not what. There is a deep urge to seek, but one knows not what one is seeking. And there is a state of mind that whatsoever you get is not going to give you any satisfaction. Frustration seems to be the destiny of humanity, because whatsoever you have got becomes meaningless the very moment you have got it. You start searching again. The search continues whether you get anything or not. It seems irrelevant what you have got, what you have not got. The search anyway continues. The poor is searching, the rich is searching, the ill is searching, the well is searching, the powerful is searching, the powerless is searching, the stupid is searching, the wise is searching, and nobody knows exactly what. This very search has to be understood. What this search is and why it is there. It seems there is a gap in a human being, in a human mind, in the very structure of human consciousness. There seems to be a hole, a black hole. You go on throwing things in it, and they go on disappearing. Nothing seems to bring it to be full. Nothing seems to help towards fulfillment. It is a very feverish search. You seek in the world, you seek it in the other world. Sometimes you seek it as money, sometimes as power, prestige, sometimes as God, bliss, love, meditation, prayer. But the search continues. It seems man is ill with search. The search does not allow you to be here and now, because the search always leads you to somewhere else. The search is a project. The search is a desire. That somewhere else is what is needed. That it exists, but it exists somewhere else, not here where you are. It certainly exists, but not in this moment of time, not now, but somewhere else. It exists then, there, never here now. It goes on nagging you. It goes on pulling you, pushing you. It goes on throwing you into more and more madness. It drives you crazy, and it never is fulfilled. I have heard about a very great Sufi mystic woman, Rabia al-Adawiya. One evening, people found her just sitting on the road searching for something. She was an old woman. Her eyes were weak. It was difficult for her to see. So neighbors came to help her. They asked, "What you are searching?" Rabia said, "That question is irrelevant. I'm searching. If you can help me, help." They laughed. They said, "Rabia, have you gone mad? You say our question is irrelevant. If we don't know what you are searching for, how can we help?" Rabia said, "Okay, so just to satisfy you, I am searching my needle. I have lost my needle." They started helping her. Then immediately they became aware that the road is very big and the needle is a very tiny thing. So they asked Rabia, "Please tell us where you lost it, the exact precise place. Otherwise it is difficult, the road is big. And we can go on searching and searching forever. Where did you lost it?" Rabia said, "Again you ask an irrelevant question. How it is concerned with my search?" They stopped. They said, "You have certainly gone crazy." Rabia said, "Okay, just to satisfy you, I have lost it in my house." They laughed. They said, "Then why you are searching here?" And Rabia is reported to have said that because here is light and there is no light in. The sun was setting, and there was a little light still on the road. This parable is very significant. Have you ever asked what you are searching? Have you ever made it a point of deep meditation, what you are searching? No. Even if in some vague moments, dreamy moments, you have some inkling what you are searching, It is never precise. It is never exact. You have not yet defined it. Because if you define it, the more it becomes defined, the more you will feel there is no need to search for it. The search can continue only in a state of vagueness, in a state of dream. When things are not clear, you simply go on searching, pulled by some inner urge, pushed by some inner urgency. One thing you know, that you need to search. This is the inner need, but you don't know what you are seeking. And unless you know what you are seeking, how can you find it? It is a vague. You think money, power, prestige, respectability. But then you see people who are respectable and people who are powerful, they are also seeking. Then you see people who are tremendously rich, they are still seeking to the very end of their life. So richness is not going to help. Power is not going to help. The search continues in spite of what you have. The search must be something else. These names, these labels, money, power, prestige, these are just to satisfy your mind. They are just to help you feel that you are searching something, that something is still undefined. Very vague feeling. The first thing for the real seeker is, for the seeker who has become a little alert, aware, is to define the search, to formulate a clear-cut concept of it, what it is, to bring it out of the dreaming consciousness, to encounter it in deep alertness, to look into it directly, to face it. Immediately a transformation starts happening. If you start defining your search, you will start losing your interest in the search. The more defined it becomes, the less it is there. Once it is clear-cutly known what it is, suddenly it disappears. It exists only when you are not attentive. Let it be repeated. The search exists only when you are sleepy. The search exists only when you are not aware. The search exists only in your unawareness. The unawareness creates the search. Yes, Rabia is right. Inside there is no light. And because inside there is no light and no consciousness, of course you go on searching outside. Because outside it seems more clear. Our senses are all extrovert. The eyes open outward. The hands move, spread outward. The legs move into the outside. The ears listen to the outside noise, sound. Whatsoever is available to you is all opening towards the outside. All the five senses moving in an extrovert way. Suddenly, you start searching there where you can see, feel, touch. Outside falls the light of the senses. And the seeker is inside. This dichotomy has to be understood. The seeker is inside, but because the light is outside, the seeker starts moving in an ambitious way, trying to find something outside which will be fulfilling. It is never going to happen. It has never happened. It cannot happen in the nature of things. Because unless you have first sought the seeker, all your search is meaningless. Unless you come to know who you are, all that you seek is futile. Because you don't know the seeker. Without knowing the seeker, how can you move in the right dimension, in the right direction? It is impossible. The first things should be considered first. So these two things are very important. First, make it absolutely clear to yourself what's your object. Don't just go on stumbling in darkness. Focus your attention on the object, what you are really searching. Because sometimes you want something else and you go on searching something else. So even if you succeed, you will not be fulfilled. Have you seen people who have succeeded? Can you find bigger failures anywhere else? You have the proverb that nothing succeeds like success. It is absolutely wrong. I would like to tell you, nothing fails like success. The proverb must be invented by stupid people. Nothing fails like success. It is said about Alexander the Great that the day he became the world conqueror, he closed the doors of his room and he started weeping. I don't know whether it really happened or not, but if he was a little intelligent, it must have happened. His generals were very much disturbed. What has happened? And they had never seen Alexander weeping. He was not that type of man. He was a great warrior. They have seen him in great difficulties, in situations where life was very much in danger, where death was very imminent, and they have not seen ever a tear coming out of his eyes. They have never seen him in any desperate, hopeless moment. What has happened to him now? And now, when he has succeeded, when he is the world conqueror, they knocked on the door, they went in, they asked, what has happened to you? Why you are crying like a child? He said, now that I have succeeded, I know it has been a failure. Now I know that I stand exactly where, exactly the same place where I used to be when I started this nonsense of world conquering. And the point has come so clear to me now, because there is no other world to conquer anymore. Otherwise I would have remained in the journey. I would have started conquering another world. There is no other world to conquer. Now there is nothing else to do. And suddenly I am thrown to myself. A successful man is always thrown in the end to himself, and then he suffers tortures of hell because he wastes his whole life. He searched and searched. He staked everything that he had, and now he is successful and his heart is empty and his soul is meaningless and there is no fragrance. There is no benediction. So the first thing is to know exactly what you are seeking. And I insist upon it because the more you focus your eyes on the object of your search, the more the object starts disappearing. When the eyes are absolutely fixed, suddenly there is nothing to seek. Immediately, your eyes start turning to yourself when there is no object for search. All objects have disappeared. There is emptiness. In that emptiness is conversion, turning in. You suddenly start looking at yourself. Now there is nothing to seek. A new desire arises to know who is this seeker. If there is something to seek, you are a worldly man. If there is nothing to seek and the question has become important to you, who is this seeker, then you are a religious man. This is the way I define the worldly and the religious. If you are still seeking something, maybe in the other life, on the other shore, in heaven, in paradise, in moksha, it makes no difference. You are a worldly man yet. If all seeking has stopped and you have suddenly become aware that now there is only one thing to know, who is this seeker in me? What is this energy that wants to seek? Who am I? Then there is a transformation. All values change suddenly. You start moving inwards. Then Rabia is no more sitting on the road and searching for a needle that is lost somewhere in the darkness of one's own inner soul. And once you have started moving inwards, in the beginning it is very dark. Rabia is right. It is very, very dark. Because for lives together you have never been in. Your eyes have become focused to the outside world. Have you watched it, observed sometimes? When you come from the road and it is very sunny and the sun is hot and there is bright light and you suddenly come inside the room, inside the house, it is dark. Because eyes are focused to the outside light, too much light. When there is too much light, eyes shrink. In darkness, eyes have to relax. A bigger aperture is needed in darkness. In light, a smaller aperture is enough. That's how your camera functions. That's how the eye functions. Camera has been invented on the lines of the human eye. So when you come suddenly from the outside, your own house looks dark, but you sit a little while and by darkness disappears. It is more light. Your eyes are settling. When you go in for many lives together, you have been outside, in the hot sun, in the world. You have completely forgotten how to enter in and how to readjust your eyes. Meditation is nothing but a readjustment of your vision. A readjustment of your seeing faculty. Of your eyes. That's what is called in India the third eye. It is not exactly an eye somewhere. It is just a readjustment, a total readjustment of your vision. By, the darkness is no more dark. A subtle, suffused light starts being felt. And if you go on looking inside, it takes time. gradually, slowly, you start feeling such a beautiful light inside. But it is not aggressive light. It is not like the sun, it is more like the moon. It is not glaring. It is not dazzling. It is very cool, it is not hot. It is very compassionate. It is very soothing. It is a balm. By and by, once you have become adjusted to the inside light, you will see that you are the very source. The seeker is the sought. Then you will see that the treasure is within you. And the whole fault consisted that you were seeking it for outside. That you were seeking it somewhere, and it has been always there inside you. It has always been here within you, and you were seeking it without. You were in a wrong direction, that's all. Everything is available to you as much as it is available to me. As much as it is available to a Buddha, to a Baal Sen, to Moses, to Muhammad. As much is available to you. You are only looking in a wrong direction. As far as the treasure is concerned, you are not poorer than Buddha or Muhammad. No, God has never created a poor man. It does not happen. It cannot happen because God creates you out of His richness. How He can create a poor man? You are His overflowing. You are part of His being. How you can be poor? You are rich, infinitely rich as God Himself. But you are looking in a wrong direction. The direction is wrong, that's why you go on missing. And it is not that you will not succeed in life, you can succeed, but still you will be a failure. Nothing is going to satisfy you. Because nothing can be attained in the outside world which can be comparable to the inner treasure, to the inner light, to the inner peace, to the inner bliss. Now this is story. This story is tremendously meaningful. Rabbi Bunam used to tell young men who came to him for the first time the story of Rabbi Isaac, son of Rabbi Ekel, in Krakow. After many years of great poverty, which had never shaken his faith in God, he dreamed that someone bade him look for treasure under the bridge which leads to the king's palace in Prague. The first thing about the story to be understood, that he dreamed. All desiring is dreaming. And all dreaming takes you away from you. That is the very nature of a dream. You may sleep in Pune, and you may dream of Philadelphia. In the morning, you will not wake up in Philadelphia. You will wake up in Pune. But in the dream, you can be anywhere. Dream has a tremendous freedom because it is unreal. In dream, you can be anywhere. On the moon, on the Mars, you can choose any planet. It's your game. In a dream you can be anywhere. Only one thing you cannot be in a dream, and that is where you are. This is the first thing to be understood about the dreaming consciousness. If you are where you are, then the dream cannot exist. Because then there's no point for the dream. Then there is no meaning in the dream. If you are exactly where you are, and you are exactly what you are, then how the dream can exist? Dream can exist only if you go away from you. You may be a poor man, and you dream about being an emperor. You may be an ordinary man, and you dream about yourself as extraordinary. You walk on the earth, you dream that you fly in the sky. The dream has to be a falsification of reality. The dream has to be something else than reality. In reality, there is no dreaming. So those who want to know the real, they have to stop dreaming. In India, we have divided the human consciousness in 4 stages. First, we call the ordinary waking consciousness. Right now, you are in the ordinary waking consciousness. What is an ordinary waking consciousness? You appear to be awake, but you are not. A little bit you are. But that little bit is so small that it doesn't make much difference. Yes, you can walk to your home. You can recognize your wife or your husband. You can drive your car. That little bit is only enough for this. It gives you a sort of efficiency. That's all. But it is a very small consciousness, adjusted very easily, lost very easily. Somebody insults you and it is lost. It is exhausted. Somebody has insulted you, you become angry. You are no more conscious. That's why after anger many people say, why I did it? How I did it? How I could do it? It happened in spite of me. Yes, they are right. It happened in spite of you because you lost your consciousness. In anger, in violent rage, people are possessed. They do things they will never do if they were a little aware. They can kill. They can destroy. They can destroy themselves. The ordinary waking consciousness is only waking for name's sake. Deep down dreams continue. Just a small tip of the iceberg is alert. The whole thing is underneath, in darkness. Watch it sometimes. Just anywhere, close your eyes and look within. You will see dreams floating like clouds surrounding you. You can sit on the chair any moment of the day, close your eyes, relax, and suddenly you will see dreams have started. In fact, they have not started. They were continuing. Just as in the day, stars disappear from the sky. They don't really disappear. They are there. But because of the light of the sun, you cannot see them. If you go in a deep well, very deep dark well, from the dark, well, you can look at the sky and you will be able to recognize few stars again, even in the midday. The stars are there, When night comes, they don't disappear, appear. They have always been there 24 hours. They don't go anywhere. Just the sunlight hides them. Exactly is the case with your dreaming. It is just below the surface. Just underground it continues. On the top of it, a little layer of awareness. Underneath, 1001 dreams. Close your eyes any time and you will find yourself dreaming. That's why people, when they start meditating, are in a great difficulty. They come to me and they say, this is something funny, strange, because we had never thought that so many thoughts are there. They had never closed their eyes. They had never sat in a relaxed posture. They have never went in to see what is happening there. They have been too much engaged in the outside world. They were too much occupied. Because of that occupation, they never became aware of this constant activity inside. The waking consciousness, ordinary waking consciousness in India is called the first state. The second state is that of dreaming. Anytime you close your eyes and you are in it. In the night you are continuously in it, almost continuously. Whether you remember your dreams or not in the morning is not of much importance. But you go on dreaming. There are at least 8 cycles of dream in the night. One cycle continues almost for many minutes, 15, 20 minutes. Then there is a gap. Then again another cycle. Then there is a gap. Then again there is a cycle. Continuously, whole night, you are dreaming and dreaming and dreaming. This is the second state of consciousness. This parable consists of the second state of consciousness. Ordinarily, all desires consist in the second state of consciousness, the dreaming state. Desire is a dream. And to work for a dream is doomed from the very beginning. Because a dream can never become real. Even if sometimes you feel it has become almost real, it never becomes real. A dream by nature is empty. It has no substance in it. The third stage is sleep, deep sleep, susupti, in which all dreaming disappears, but all consciousness also. While you are awake, there is a little awareness, very little. When you are dreaming, even that little awareness has disappeared, but still there is an iota of awareness. That's why you can remember in the morning that you had a dream, such and such a dream. But in deep sleep, even that disappears, as if you have completely disappeared. Nothing remains. A nothingness surrounds you. These are the 3 ordinary states. The fourth state is called Turiya. The fourth is simply called the fourth. Turiya means the fourth. The fourth state is of a Buddha. It is almost like dreamless sleep, with only one difference. That difference is very great. It is as peaceful as deep sleep, as without dreams as deep sleep, but it is absolutely alert, aware. Krishna says in his Gita that a real yogi never sleeps. That does not mean that a real yogi simply sits in his room the whole night. There are few foolish people doing that too. A real yogi never sleeps means, even while he is asleep, he remains aware, alert. Ananda lived with Buddha for 40 years. He asked Buddha one day, "One thing surprises me very much. I'm intrigued, and you will have to answer me. He said, "It is just out of curiosity, but I cannot contain it anymore. You sleep in the night. I have watched you many times for hours together. But you sleep in such a way that it seems as if you are awake. You sleep in such a graceful way. Your face, your body, everything is so graceful. I have seen many other people sleeping," he said. "They start mumbling. Their face goes through contrastations. Their body loses all grace. Their face becomes ugly, they don't look any more beautiful. Because all beauty has to be managed, controlled, practiced. In deep sleep, it all disappears. And one thing more," Ananda said, "you never change your posture, you remain in the same posture. Wherever you keep your hand in the beginning, you keep the whole night. You never change it. It seems deep down you are keeping absolutely alert." Buddha said, "You are right. That happens when meditation is perfect. Then awareness penetrates your being so deeply that you are aware in all the four states. When you are aware in all the four states, then dreaming absolutely disappears. Because in an alert mind, dream cannot exist. And the ordinary waking state becomes extraordinary waking state. What Gurdjieff calls self-remembering. One remembers oneself absolutely each moment. There is no gap. The remembrance is a continuity. One becomes a luminous being. And deep sleep is there, but its quality changes completely. The body is fast asleep, but the soul is awake and alert, watchful. The whole body is deep in darkness, but the lamp of inner consciousness burns bright." This story says, after many years of great poverty, which had never shaken his faith in God, he dreamed that someone bade him look for treasure under the bridge which leads to the king's palace in Prague. After many years of great poverty, it is natural that one should start dreaming about treasures. We always dream about that which we don't have. Fast one day and in the night you will dream about food. Try to force celibacy upon yourself and your dreams will become sexual. They will have a quality of sexuality. That's why psychoanalysis says analysis of the dream is of tremendous import, because it shows what you are repressing. Your dream becomes a symbolic indication of the repressed content of your mind. If a person continuously dreams about food, about feasts, that simply shows that person is somehow starving himself. Jaina monks always dream about food. They may say, they may not say. If you fast too much, you are bound to dream about food. That's why many religious saints become so afraid of getting into sleep. Even Mahatma Gandhi was very afraid to go into sleep. He was trying to reduce it to as less as possible. Religious people make it a point not to sleep too long. 4 hours, 5 hours at the most. 3 is the ideal. Why? Because once your bodily need of the rest is complete, your mind starts weaving, spinning dreams. And immediately the mind brings things which you have been repressing. Mahatma Gandhi has said that I have become a celibate as far as my waking consciousness is concerned, but in my dreams I am not a celibate. He was a true man in a sense, truer than other so-called saints. At least he accepted it, that in his dreams he is not yet celibate. But unless you are celibate in your dreams, you are not celibate. Because the dream says whatsoever you are repressing in the day, the dream simply brings it back to your consciousness. Dream is a language, a communication from the unconscious. The unconscious is saying, please, don't do this to me. It is impossible to tolerate it. Stop this nonsense. You are destroying my natural spontaneity. Allow me whatsoever is potential in me to flower. When a person represses nothing, dreams disappear. So a Buddha never dreams. If your meditation will go deep, you will find it immediately. Your dreams are becoming less and less and less. The day your dreams completely disappear, and you attain to a clarity in your sleep, no clouds, no smoke, no thoughts, simple, silent sleep, without any interference of dreams, then you have become a Buddha. Then your meditation has come to fruition. Psychoanalysis insists that the dreams have to be understood, because man is very cunning. He can deceive while he is awake, but he cannot deceive when he is in a dream. A dream is truer. Look at the irony. A dream is more true about you than your so-called waking consciousness. Man has become so false. Man is so fake. Your waking consciousness cannot be relied upon. You have corrupted it too much. Psychoanalyst immediately goes to your dreams. He wants to know about your dreams. He does not want to know about your religion. He does not want to know about your philosophy of life. He does not want to know whether you are a Hindu or a Christian, Indian or an American. That is all nonsense. He wants to know what are your dreams. Look at the irony. Your dreams have become so real that your reality is less real than your dreams. You are living such a pseudo-life, inauthentic, false, that the psychoanalyst has to go to your dreams to find few glimpses of truth. Only your dreams are still beyond your control. There are people who try to control dreams also. In East, methods have been invented to control even dreams. That means you are even not allowing the unconscious to convey any message to you. You can do that too. You can cultivate dreams if you work hard. You can start planning your dreams. You can give a story to your own unconscious to unfold in the dream. If you do it consistently and every day, by and by, you will be able to corrupt the unconscious. For example, once a devotee of Krishna stayed with me. He said, "I always dream of Krishna." I asked him, "How you managed?" Because dream is not something that you can manage. What method you have tried? He said, "A simple method my guru had given to me. That every night when I go to sleep, I go on thinking and thinking about Krishna, fantasizing. After 3 years of continuous practicing fantasy while falling asleep, one day it happened. Whatsoever I had fantasied continued in my dream, and it became my dream. Since then I am having tremendous religious dreams." I said, "You just go into details, because you may have managed the story, but the unconscious must be sending messages in the story itself. The unconscious can use your story to send its messages. You may have managed." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You simply give me the content of your dream, detailed content." And he started telling me, and it was absolutely sexual. Krishna was his lover, and he had become a male gopi. A boyfriend. The content was homosexual. And they were dancing together, kissing and hugging and loving each other. I said, "You have simply changed the figure, but the content remains still. And my understanding is that you are a homosexual." He was very much disturbed and shocked. He said, "What do you mean? How you came to know about it? Your dream is a clear message." He said, he started crying and weeping. He said, "From my very childhood, I have never felt attracted towards women. I was always attracted towards men. And I was..." He said that, "I was thinking that it is a good help, because women will distract me from my path." Now the homosexual content has entered into his religious story. Now Krishna is nothing but a homosexual partner. He became very much disturbed. And that very night the dream disappeared. And a pure homosexual dream entered. He said, "What you have done to me?" I said, "I have not done anything. I have simply made your message clear to you. You can even fabricate a story, but that doesn't matter. The inner content remains the same. You just see, you go to a person who is not religious, you will find in Indian homes, in bachelor's homes, nude pictures of women. The man is not religious. But you go to a religious man, he may have beautiful pictures of gods and goddesses, but just look at the content, at the detail of it. Whether it is a film actress, or whether it is a goddess, makes no difference. Just look at the breasts. They will indicate you exactly the same content. The story is different. Somebody has a picture of a goddess on his wall. and somebody has Elizabeth Taylor or somebody else's picture or Sophia Loren, that makes no difference. Whether you call her a goddess or you call her a film actress makes no difference. Look at the detail and you will see what that man is hankering after. You can even manipulate your dreams. You can even destroy the purity of your unconscious messages, but still the unconscious will go on giving you messages. It has to give. It has to scream to you because you are destroying your own nature, your own spontaneity. Now this dream happened after many years of great poverty. Which had never shaken his faith in God. He dreamed that someone bade him look for treasure under the bridge which leads to the king's palace in Prague. Poor men always dream of king's palaces and king's treasures and things like that. If you have very rich dreams, that simply shows you are a poor man. Only very rich people dream of Bhikkhuni Sannyasins. A Buddha, a Mahavir, living in the palaces, they have dreams of Bhikkhuni Sannyasins. Because they are fed up with their success. Success is finished for them. It has no charm. It has no allurement. It has no fascination anymore. Now they think the poor man is living the real life. Now they start seeking somewhere else where they are not. But always the dream goes somewhere else. The rich man thinks the poor is having the real life. And the poor man thinks the rich is having the real life. But the fallacy is the same. They both think real life is somewhere else where I am not. Somehow I am always excluded from the real life. Somebody else is enjoying it. Life is happening always somewhere else. Wherever I go, life simply disappears. Wherever I reach for it, I always find emptiness. But it is always happening somewhere. Life seems to be like the horizon. It is just ahead, somewhere. It is a mirage. When the dream recurred the third time, he set out for Prague. And remember, even if a dream recurs too many times, it starts looking like real. Repetition makes things real. Adolf Hitler has written in his autobiography, Mein Kampf, that you go on repeating a lie and it becomes real. The repetition is the key. And he should know. He practiced it. And he is not simply asserting something theoretical. He has practiced it whole of his life. He uttered lies. Absolutely absurd lies. But one thing he insisted, he went on repeating. When you went on repeating some lie again and again and again, it starts becoming real. Because the mind starts getting hypnotized by it. Repetition is the method of hypnosis. Repeat anything and it becomes engraved in your being. That's how we are deluded in life. If you repeat, this woman is beautiful, this woman is beautiful, you go on repeating and you will start seeing beauty in her. It may be there, it may not be there. It doesn't matter. If you repeat it too long, it will become true. If you think money is the goal of life, go on repeating, and it will become your goal of life. That's how all advertising functions. Just go on repeating. The advertiser believes in the science of repetition. He simply goes on repeating that this brand of cigarette is the best. When for the first time you read it, you may not believe it. Next time, again, again, how long you can remain an unbeliever? By and by the belief will arise. And the belief will be such that you may not even become conscious of it. It will be subliminal. It will be just underneath consciousness. One day suddenly, when you will go to the store, and the storekeeper will ask, what brand of cigarette do you need? And you will say, a certain brand. That repetition worked. It hypnotized you. That's how religions have been functioning in the world, and the whole politics depends on it. Advertisement. Go on repeating to the public. And don't be bothered whether they believe or not. That's not the point. Hitler says there is only one difference between truth and lie. The truth is one lie that has been repeated too often. And man can believe any lies. Man's gullibility is infinite. Man can believe in hell, man can believe in heaven, man can believe in angels, man can believe in devils, man can believe in anything. Just you go on repeating. And there is no need to argue. An advertisement never argues. Have you observed the fact? There is no need to argue. The advertisement simply persuades you. It never argues. A arguer may not be able to convince you, but a person who pursues you, who simply goes on throwing soft suggestions at you, not direct arguments. Because when somebody argues with you, you may become defensive. But if somebody goes on simply hinting at certain things, and not in any direct way, just supposing, you are more prone to be convinced by it. Dream functions that way. Dream is a salesman. Dream simply goes on repeating itself. It never argues. It simply insists being repeated. Too often repeated, one starts believing in it. When it happened thrice, he set out for Prague. He started believing in its reality. But the bridge was guarded day and night, and he did not dare start digging. In the world there is too much competition. And every place is guarded. And every object has to be fought for. It is not easy. This is something very strange in this world. Nothing is meaningful. And for everything you have to fight too much. Nothing seems to be significant, but much competition, much conflict. Because everybody is rushing towards it, that creates the trouble. Not that there is something in it, there is nothing in it, but everybody is trying to rush towards it. Everybody is hankering for everybody else's place. That's why the world is so crowded. In fact, it is not so crowded as it seems. Look, we are sitting here. Everybody is sitting in his own place. This place is not crowded at all. But suddenly a frenzy gets hold of your mind and everybody starts trying to reach into another's place, then this place will be crowded. Right now you are sitting religiously, then you will be rushing at each other politically. Right now you are satisfied with the place you have and you are not hankering for anybody's place, at least not in this Chuangtazu auditorium. But if you start pushing yourself into others' places, others will become defensive. They will start pushing you. A fight, a war will ensue. Why there are so many wars in the world? The reason is this, that everybody is trying to have another's territory. And the other may be trying the same. He may be looking at you. The bridge was guarded and he could not start digging. Nevertheless, he went to the bridge every morning and kept walking around it until evening. That's what many people are doing. Very few succeed. Many simply walk around. But they go. Even if you cannot succeed, your desires, your hopes are continuously there. At least you can go at the place near the palace. You can simply walk around. The whole day from morning to evening he was walking around. That's what many people are doing. Waiting for some miracle to happen. Someday maybe there are no guards. Someday maybe there is a holiday. Someday there is a possibility to dig. One waits and one goes on waiting. It never happens. But one's whole life is wasted in waiting. Nevertheless, he went to the bridge every morning and kept walking around it until evening. Finally, the captain of the guards, who had been watching him, asked in a kindly way whether he was looking for something or waiting for someone. Rabbi Isaac told him of the dream which had brought him from a faraway country. The captain laughed. "And so to please your dream, you wore out your shoes to come here, you poor fellow. And as for having faith in dreams, if I had it, I should have had to go to Krakow and dig for treasure under the stove in the room of a Jew, Isaac, son of Ekel. That's what the dream told me. And imagine what it would have been like. One half of the Jews over there are called Isaac and the other half Ekel." And he laughed again. Rabbi Isaac Bodge traveled home, dug up the treasure from under his stove and built the house of prayer which is called Reb Isaac's Shul. It is a beautiful story and very true. That's how it is happening in life. You are looking somewhere else for that which is already there within you. Rabbi Isaac Bodge thanked the man, traveled home. This is the journey of religion, traveling back home. And a man who has understood life always pays its respect to life because it has sucked you out of your dreams. He is not against life. He simply knows it has nothing to do with life. He simply knows I was searching in a wrong direction. Life has been always compassionate. Life has been telling you again and again, that nothing you can find here. Go back home. But you don't listen. You earn money, one day money is there. And life says to you now what you have got. But you don't listen. Now you think you have to put your money into politics. You have become a prime minister or a president. Then everything will be okay. One day you are a prime minister. Life says again what you have got. You don't listen. You go on thinking of something else and something else and something else. Life is vast. That's why many lives are wasted. But don't be angry at life. It is not life that is frustrating you. It is you who are not listening to life. And this is, I call, a criterion, a touchstone. If you see some saint who is against life, bitter against life, know well, he has not understood yet. Otherwise, he will bow down to life in deep respect, reverence, because life has awakened him out of his dreams. Life is very shocking. That's why life is painful. The pain comes because you are desiring something which is not possible. It doesn't come from life. It comes from your expectations. People say, man proposes and God disposes. It has never happened. God has never disposed anybody. But in your own proposition, you have disposed yourself. Listen to God's proposition. Keep your propositions to yourself. Keep quiet. Listen what the whole is willing. Don't try to have your private goals. Don't try to have your private desires. Don't ask anything individually. The whole is moving towards its destiny. You simply be part to it. Cooperate. Don't be in a conflict. Surrender to it. And life always sends you back to your own reality. That is why it is shocking. It shocks you because it doesn't fulfill your dreams. It is good that life never fulfills your dreams. It always goes on disposing in a way. It gives you 1,001 opportunities to be frustrated so that you can understand that expectations are not good and dreams are futile and desires are never fulfilled. Then you drop desiring, you drop dreaming, you drop proposing. Suddenly you are back home and the treasure is there. Rabbi Isaac Bode traveled home, dug up the treasure from under his stove and built the house of prayer which is called Reb Isaac Sul. The treasure has always been waiting there under his stove. He had dreamed in the same room that the treasure is somewhere near the palace of the king in Prague. And it was just there. It was just there to be dug into his own room, into his own house. This is very indicative. Your treasure is also in your own being. Don't look for it somewhere else. All palaces and all bridges to the palaces are meaningless. You have to create your own bridge within your own being. The palace is there and the treasure is there. God never sends anybody into this world without a treasure. He sends you ready for every situation. How it can be otherwise, a father sending his son on a long journey? He makes every preparation, even for unexpected situations. the father provides. He gives all the provisions. You are carrying everything that you need. Just go into the seeker and don't go seeking outside. Seek the seeker. Let the seeker be the sought. And because of this, he built the house of prayer. Why he built the house of prayer? Such a tremendous revelation. Such a tremendous experience. That God has put the treasure where I have always lived. I was poor because of myself. I was not poor because God wanted me to be poor. As far as He is concerned, I was a king, always a king. Because of this understanding, He made a prayer house, a temple, out of this treasure. He used it well. Whenever somebody comes to his innermost treasure, prayer arises. That is the meaning of this story. That he made a house of prayer which is called Reb Izitzul. Whenever you understand the grace of God, the compassion, the love, what else you can do? A great prayer of thankfulness arises into your being. You feel so overpowered by His love, overwhelmed. What else can you do? You simply bow down and you pray. And remember, if you pray to ask for something, it is not prayer. When you pray to thank Him for something, only then it is prayer. Prayer is always a thanksgiving. If you ask something, then the prayer is still corrupted by desire. Then it is not prayer yet. It is still poisoned by dreaming. A real prayer is only when you have attained to yourself. When you have known what God has given to you already without your asking for it. When you realize what you have been given, what infinite sources have been given to you, a prayer arises. You would like to say to God, thank you. There is nothing else in it but a pure thank you. When a prayer is just a thank you, it is prayer. Never ask anything in a prayer. Never say, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. Never advise God. That shows your irreligiousness. That shows lack of trust. Thank Him. Your life is already a benediction, a blessing. Each moment is such pure joy, but you are missing it. That I know. That's why the prayer is not arising. Otherwise, you will build a house of prayer. Your whole life will become that house of prayer. You will become the temple, His shrine. His song will burst from your being. He will flower in you and His fragrance will spread to the winds. It is not happening because you are missing something. And you are missing not because of Him, you are missing because of you. If you desire and you think somewhere else is the treasure, you move in the future. Future is needed because you desire. Future is a byproduct of desiring. How you can project desire in the present? The present is already here. You cannot project any desire in it. The present does not allow desire. The present, if you desire, is gone already. You can desire only in the future, only in the tomorrow. This has to be understood. Desire is always in the future, and future is never there. Future is that which is not, and desire is only in the future. And desire comes out of the past, which is also not. Past is gone, future has not come yet. Desire comes out of the past because what you desire, you must have known somehow in the past. How can you desire something absolutely new? You cannot desire the new. You can only ask for some repetition. You had some money, you will ask for more, but money you know. You had some power, you ask for more, but power you know. Man cannot desire the unknown. The desire is just a repetition of the known. Just look at it. You have known it, and you are not fulfilled, and you are again asking it. And you think you will be fulfilled. At the most, you can ask for more quantity. But if 1 rupee is not fulfilling, how 10,000 rupees can be fulfilling? If 1 rupee is unfulfilling, 10,000 rupees will be 10,000-fold more unfulfilling. That is simple logic. If 1 woman has not fulfilled you, then 10,000 women are not going to fulfill you. If 1 woman has created such a hell, then 10,000 women, just think. It is a simple arithmetic, you can solve it. You can ask only out of the past, and you can ask only in the future, and both are non-existential. That which exists is the present. This very moment is the only moment there is. You cannot desire in it. You can just be in it. You can just enjoy it. And I have never come across a person who can be miserable in the present. You will be surprised. Many times people come to me and they say they are very miserable, this and that. And I say to them, close your eyes and right now find it out whether you are miserable or not. They close their eyes, they open their eyes, they say, right now I am not miserable. Right now nobody is miserable. There is no possibility. It is not allowed by the nature of things. This very moment, are you miserable? This very moment, you may have been miserable a moment before. Okay, that is right. Or you may be miserable a moment afterwards. That too is allowed. But this very moment, between these two non-existential moments, are you miserable? Nobody has ever been. This moment is always of pure benediction. This moment is always of joy, of tremendous delight. This moment is God's moment. The past is yours, the future is yours. The present is God's. We divide time in 3 tenses, past, present, future. We should not divide that way. That division is not right. Time is divided between past and future. The present is not part of time, it is part of eternity. God has no past, remember. You cannot say God was. God has no future. You cannot say God will be. God has only 1 tense, present. God is. God always is. In fact, God is only another name for the isness of existence. Whenever you are also in the moment, whenever you are also in this isness, you are happy, blessed, a prayer arises. You become a shrine. You should become Reb Izik-Sul. You should become a prayer house. Rabbi Bunam used to add, take this story to heart and make what it says your own. There is something you cannot find anywhere in the world. Not even at the Zadiks. And there is nevertheless a place where you can find it. Zadik means the master. The word Zadik comes from a Hebrew root which means the pure, the purest. Purity itself. The Zadik means the master who has attained to his presentness, who is no more in the past and no more in the future, who is just here now, who is just a presence. To be in the presence of a master is to be just in the presence of a presence, that's all. And to be in the presence of a master can help you to be present. Because his presence can become infectious. But Rabbi Bunam says, there is something you cannot find anywhere in the world, not even at the Zadiks. He says, there is something which you cannot find anywhere, not even in the presence of a master. But don't feel hopeless. There is nevertheless a place where you can find it. And that place is you. And that time is now. In fact, the Zadik's, the master's effort is nothing but to throw you to your presentness. To make you available to God. Or to make God available to you. This presentness cannot be taught, but it can be caught. Hence the value of satsang, of being in the presence of a zadik, of a master, of a guru. Just to be there doing nothing. In fact, a master is doing not anything. He is just there. A master is a prayer, a constant thankfulness, which each breath he is thanking God. Not verbally. His very breathing is a thankfulness. His each beat of the heart. He goes on saying, thank you. Thank you, not verbally. Existentially. His being is prayer. To be in the presence of such a man may help you to have some taste of prayer. That taste will start a new journey into your life, the inward journey. Seeking you have been for centuries, for millennia, and you have not found. Now, let the seeker be the search. Outside you have traveled so long. You are so tired, so exhausted. Jesus says, those who are tired, those whose burden is heavy, they should come to me. I will give them rest. What he means? He simply means, come to me, I am in rest. Be close to me. Have a taste of it. And that very taste will turn the tide. and you will start moving inwards. You are here with me. Have the taste of my being. Don't just listen to my words. Listen to me. Taste me. And then suddenly you will be here and now. And you will be turning inwards. And you will not ask for anything. And you will not desire for anything. And you will not have any movement in the future. And you will not have any clinging with the past. And then this moment is liberation. This moment is enlightenment. Enough for today.